Welcome to the Victory Show.
Welcome to the Victory Show, where seven-figure founders, entrepreneurs, and executives reveal the real playbook behind scaling past that first million in recurring revenue. We go beyond the highlight reel and into the hard lessons, costly mistakes, key growth inflection points, and the human decisions that shape the numbers. And here's the twist. Every conversation becomes a chapter in the Victory book series, so the next generation of founders and builders doesn't have to start from scratch. Today's guest is Michael J. Mazzeo, who brings the rigor of institutional investing and the agility of entrepreneurship under one roof. Michael is the founder and CEO of Eagle Global Holdings, a modern family investment office built to do more than preserve capital. It's designed to multiply it. Michael's a disciplined capital allocator and strategic thinker who operates across both public and private markets, combining long-term value creation with intelligent risk management. At the helm of Eagle Global, he fuses entrepreneurial execution with deep investment acumen, delivering the kind of operational precision and portfolio strategy normally found in the upper echelons of institutional finance. So if you've ever been interested in what it takes to steward capital with both conviction and discipline, then this is going to be a fantastic conversation you'll want to pay attention to. Michael, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Travis, for having me.
I know I said this earlier. I'm going to say it again just because it's astounding to me. You look so young to have started your own family office. You want to take me on your journey a little bit of like, how did you get there? And more importantly, did you know this is where you were going to be?
Yeah. In a way, yes. In a way, yes, Travis. I'm a big fan of, you know, beginning with the end in mind, right? And you know, as I said, so as early as high school, I knew that I wanted to be on the investment side of things, on the buy side of things, and that led to my educational choices. So I went to Duke University, majored in economics, and with a minor in education, and that helped spawn the first sort of business, which was called Chance Academic Advising, Inc. And that was an education company I started, which had its roots as a tutoring business, but has now since transformed into an education software business, as well as a curriculum design company, where we serve students, teachers, educators, and school systems. Beyond that, I, you know, pursued a career at Goldman Sachs, and, which ultimately led to another business called Tradeweb, where I worked for the founder and the chairman, expanding that business globally, and then started my own private equity firm with a business partner at age 24. And that was really the strongest connecting dot to where I am today, because just a couple of years later, I started Eagle Global Holdings and have been doing that for just about 9 years now. So that's kind of approaching 9 years.
So what was it in high school that led you to realize that you wanted to be on the investing side? Because most of the people I knew when I was a teenager, they weren't thinking about investing.
Yeah, it was just, you know, it came to just like sort of a natural question of like, what's this all about, right? Like, what is everyone's parents doing at home when they're not at home, right? And as a kid, you know, we all had so many questions. Like, money was like this thing that like you had to ask for, but you nobody wanted to spend, and at times people didn't have it for you, and there's just so many mysteries around like money, and there was mysteries around, you know, why people end up where they were. So I started to just dive deep and like we need to track where the money actually is, and we need to figure out this money problem, because not that I grew up, I would say, impoverished, but I grew up with very well-educated parents. But I think all of us children, no matter what your socioeconomic status is, we're always warned, don't spend money. You know, money was a hard thing to get. It wasn't just thrown around. So my friends and I actually wanted to find a career where resources were something that wasn't a big problem. So that naturally led to investments. So investments you know, that's where people who control the capital, and they control the capital that's invested into businesses. And as you know, businesses is the lifeblood of the American economy. Small business or medium-sized businesses are the lifeblood of the American economy. So when you follow where the money goes, it leads to private equity, it leads to hedge funds, it leads to family offices. And that's where kind of I was like, well, I would like to have one of these of my own one day. And that's what led to that. You know, I knew going into Goldman Sachs that I was going to start a private equity company. I just need to find the right partner, the right team to do it with me. And then that was going to hopefully lead to something more, something greater for me, which, you know, for me, money isn't just like this thing to like hoard over and just to have and that other people, some people have, some people don't have. It's for me, money is something that it buys freedom and it buys like, and it buys choice in life. So I always wanted to be in a position where, you know, being a steward of capital was something that, you know, my decision-making processes with regard to investments led to, you know, higher rates of return or led to an increase in the money supply, led an increase in growth. So I had always a knack for locating, you know, good businesses and bad businesses. Like that's a skill set that I had as an early, you know, I could tell, you know, quantifying about how much a pizza store would make just by sitting outside one day as I was 16, as past people were going in and out. And I'd say, okay, this is about how much they're looking at. This is their cost structure. Maybe owning pizzas are good for me, but working in a pizza store is not for me. Like, and things like, and just sort of like thinking about the economy as such, it led to a career in investments.
Wow.
The other potential careers that I would have chosen were on the table was being a surgeon or being an attorney. And I, for a variety of reasons, didn't think that my skill set could hold up as I aged. I didn't, like, if I had arthritis in my hands, what would happen if I become a surgeon later in life? That would be, as well as just the demands of that profession, I think it's very hard to balance a family life. And then same thing, you know, with an attorney. I love the law. I've studied the law and a lot of times. It's just the idea of taking on clients and being unsure of your caseload was something that I didn't like. There was not much not a lot of control over your schedule. So I wanted something where I had a lot of control over my schedule and free time.
That's so interesting you say that about a surgeon. I'm friendly with a guy who's a top surgeon, and it was so fascinating because he got to a point in his career where the hospital actually insured his right hand for like $10 million or something. But then there was all these requirements that came along with that. And like, it completely changed his life because he basically got to the point where he always had something in his hand just to remind himself that like, He now when he goes out, he doesn't open doors with his right hand. He doesn't like eat with his right hand. He like everything is now with his left hand. Like his right hand is like guarded. And I just remember spending a day with him one time and just watching it. It was like, now to that point for him, it wasn't, but I was just like, you're giving up like the use of your hand for like when you're not working for the better part of a day. Cause that was, you know, that's like, if he injured it, that was it. His career was done. And I just thought like, it's awesome that you can do that and have that. But at the same time, like, boy, like that stress to me seemed like, boy.
A lot of stress. I have several friends who are surgeons and not quite that experienced, but it's an incredibly demanding and not for everybody.
So with your, with Goldman Sachs, when you went, started there, like how long did you work with Goldman Sachs? Were you there just a few years?
I was just there about a year. Yeah, quick.
What were some of the like big lessons you learned right out of the gate when you that first year we were with them?
Just under a year. The lessons I learned from Goldman Sachs was about sort of spotting opportunity. All right. So the desk that I was a part of was their equity derivatives desk, as well as their foreign exchange trading, as well as their electronic trading. And these were some of their most prestigious investment desks, because they were always looking for opportunity, whether it was in the foreign exchange markets, whether it was in equity stocks or derivatives, or whether it was in their electronic trading group, which was just starting out as like a thing when electronic trading was like a thing. And this was going back 15 years ago. So in many ways, the whole culture is, they sort of joke around that, everybody drinks the Kool-Aid over there, but there is something very special about their secret sauce, which is communication. Everybody's in communication with each other. Information flows extremely quickly. Accuracy is the most important thing. You make one mistake there, or you're wrong about a news release, or you're wrong about an earnings date, or you're wrong. And it's the impact to just one group is overwhelming and could be extremely devastating. So the amount of trust that each team member has and the responsibility that they have is enormous to their specific team that they're a part of, and every person is part of a different team. But communication is incredibly important, and spotting opportunity that others may miss. So looking through, the last thing I will say to answer that question is pattern recognition. Their pattern recognition is extremely high, whether you work on their investment banking group or whether you work in their securities, their trading stocks and trade sales and trading group. They call it the securities division. That their pattern recognition is probably higher than anybody else in the industry on the sell side, right? So there's the buy side, which are investment funds, hedge funds, family offices, private equity firms, and then there's the sell side, which are investment banks, and they're an investment bank, so they're selling and bringing things to market. So they're, in my opinion, it's no surprise why their stock has been head over heels above their peers, because the performance indicates the specialness of the firm. Not just because I went there, but just because I had the opportunity to see and compare it to people who have worked elsewhere.
That's so fascinating, the pattern and recognition. Is it? So I was just watching a interview with Tony Robbins, and somebody asked him what his superpower was, and that's what he said. Is it my superpower?
Pattern recognition. Tony Robbins,
Now, obviously, he's not talking about investments, right? He's talking about other stuff. But eventually, when he was in his 50s and he started studying the greatest investors of all time, that was what he said. One of the things that they ultimately all that's fascinating. All right, so let's talk a little bit about. So when you started your own fund, how did you determine like what your values were going to be? Like, did you get those from working from Goldman Sachs, or did you at a young age, did you know like kind of what your focus was going to be and what was going to be important to you running your own fund?
Yeah. And we had a whole week-long workshop where we worked with an executive coach and we hammered out, in our private equity firm, Elm Equity Partners, Elliot, my co-founder and myself, we had about 18 employees. And we hammered out what it means to work here and what those core values are. And we brought them to Seattle, where we had acquired businesses under the brand, and we had sort of changed some of the values. But it came down to like things like grit, accountability, member centric, right? That wasn't there at the private equity, but that was there at the company level when we bought out businesses. Our customers weren't just customers; we made them members, right? Like at Costco, you're a member, right? Or at certain organizations, you're a member; you're not just a customer. So we elevated our customer standards and our customer service. So we were member centric and fanatical about that. And then the other two were kind of like routine values. Entrepreneurial and relentless or something like that. It was just sort of like, a reflection of how Elliot and I were. We were relentless. We had a lot of grit. We were always accountable. If we made a mistake, we admit it. This is a situation, we move on. And so, you can't really get more than like five, or think about like a fit on your hand. We found that to be, something that makes sense. And we transposed those to the portfolio companies that we had acquired. We just made some small modifications. because they did not come from Goldman Sachs. They came from who Elliot and I were as people. We weren't chill, just, you know, like some of the people on the West Coast we bought businesses from, who are like very, you know, relaxed and easy does it. You know, we were there to 10x things, 100x things. You know, we were there to really move the dial, because we had sacrificed a lot to get there. Some of us had sacrificed relationships, family, things like that. So there was a sense of urgency that everybody would operate under, but not a sense of fear. There was a line between, you know, that and that. Like, we did a lot for the employees, like all the salespeople and had Amexes, company Amexes, and, you know, we had like kind of a lot of get-togethers and group get-togethers. We had people giving massages to employees in the offices. I mean, we treated everybody very, very well, and that's because the standards were so, so high that we call them A, B, C, not even ranking after C players. In the organization, the C players were just eliminated, and our goal was always to get B players to become A players, because you need B players. Every organization, just, you know, that's just the way it is. Not everyone's an A player. That like, A players are intrinsically motivated. So our core values always resonated with A players. The B players had to really try to understand why they were like that, but then eventually they got them, and they would have to go through a training to become an A player, or at least an A minus player, just something to elevate. Everybody needs to grow. Everybody was on their own performance improvement plan, even A players. How do I become like an A plus? Or like, how do I, and like, you know, and that was kind of like, how do I become outstanding was really the question that people would ask, not just good or great. And that meant something different to everybody, and everybody had a different career track, but we were fanatical about, you know, human capital management, personnel management, whatever you want to call it, HR. It was not just a random thing. You know, here's our values. Everybody knew it. It was inculcated into who they are. Weekly meetings about the values and how they saw it exhibited by one of their peer colleagues. There was all sorts of things like that in the organization.
Well, that's fascinating to me. So what are some of the things you've done internally then to help train just not even your employees, but the founders or the leaders of these organizations? When you say they have a personal improvement plan, like, is that something you create with them, or is that something they create?
Yeah. Well, I was, and this is, you know, a confession by me, Travis. I tend to find managing people extremely difficult, and you know, so I always try to, you know, put, you know, the people who are great managers in those seats, and then work with them, right? So I was always at the, you know, at the board level of these companies, or the lowest rank I took was a COO for a period of time. Of a portfolio company. And so I was always interacting with the heads of departments or something like that. So to put somebody on a, you know, an improvement plan, it was just like, how are we going to make sure that our engineering and software is going to be, you know, at where it is today, run level, versus, you know, 20% higher next year. And so there was, you know, mathematical benchmarks for guys like that, but they were all naturally driven, or they would have been removed from their position, because these are very high positions, you know, head of software architecture, head of engineering, head of sales. I mean, sure, these are naturally driven people. So they didn't really need it. They were putting other people under performance improvement plans. But I would just say, yeah, for you to make X amount of money, or for you to get into this bonus quadrant, or for you to get more stock, this is what I'm going to need to see from you. And I would architect what's known as an employee scorecard for the head of the division, and say, like, look, like, for first, you know, for you personally, John Smith, to get more, we need X amount here, and here's how 20% EBITDA growth flows here, and here's where it needs to come from, and that's how you can get more stock. And so, like, I would explain to them you know, because we're talking about stock compensation at this point with people like that, enhanced compensation. So they would, everybody knew what they had to do to get to the next level, because there's always another level. Even for me, yeah, I had the chairman of the company, who was one of our LPs, who served as the chairman of the businesses that we ran primarily out of Seattle. He had in his career, you know, been a part of 50 VC investments or something like that. And he was a Harvard Law degree, and, you know, just a real phenomenal intellect and great guy. And, you know, he always had something for me and my partner as well, you know, to get us to the next level, and what that would mean too. So it wasn't just always one way, it was all around. And he had an audit committee for him so that he can get to the next level too. And like, we were all fanatical about, you know, about growth, and about, not just achievement. I wouldn't mix up achievement with growth. We're all achieved a lot. It's just constantly growing. Just when you think that there's never enough, there is. And it's not without sacrificing sleep. It's focusing in on the little things and seeing that they can, you know, you can make a big difference. I hope that answers that, Travis.
I love that. Well, you said something really interesting, which is, you know, I worked with a woman on a book about a year and a half ago, and she was giving me the statistics in like the Fortune 500 companies, a C-suite leader their average lifespan is 18 months. And she was one of them. She became a VP at a Fortune 100 company, and she was there for 16 months before they let her go. And she was talking about the culture in some of those bigger companies where they're hiring leaders to solve a problem, but then they're not giving the leaders any training or direction or resources. They're just kind of like, oh, this guy seems smart, maybe they can figure it out. And so you're coming in and you're investing in these companies, and part of your, you know, strategy and philosophy is like, hey, we need to make everybody raise their standards. And that just, it's a very unusual viewpoint. So
yeah,
that's fantastic. And
the thing I would just add to that is the key component of that is belief, belief in yourself, and to believe it's possible. You would not believe how many conversations we had with prior. Oh, that's never been done, Michael. What do you mean? we can't take in a 300 user client. Our infrastructure can't handle that. And it just, the amount of pre-programmed no, until I was like, well, guess what? This is going to happen because we're closing this client. And then they change their ways. And then you get this amazing teamwork where, you know, his psychology needs to change, his behavior needs to change, whatever you want to call it. His resistance needs to change. And it's not from a dark place or a place of no, it's just, they're just pre-programmed and trained a certain way. And we were coming in there, as I said, to 100x this thing. So like, I don't need another 3-user client. I don't need another 30-user client. We would onboard them, but that doesn't move the dial. What moves the dial are 300-user clients, 1,000-user clients, things like that, that move the, you know, geometric mathematics of where we wanted to be as a player in a niche cloud space, whatever we were doing, software. And a lot of it was sales team being told they couldn't from engineering, and engineering just thinking because the way they've always done it is the way it's always going to be. And that's the way it has to be, because why would we do anything different? And they don't understand. There's a lot of miscommunication between financial goals for a business and then different departmental goals. And so it's breaking down those barriers that I would say, and that I would advise a lot of founders, breaking down the barriers that you've built in your mind and that the other people have chosen to embrace, to become the first step to becoming right an A player is knowing that you can be one, right? So all the B players in the organization, they will literally on forms in the very beginning, when we started the training and the employee stuff, they know they're not A players. There was never one incident where someone who thought, right? We have a B player who thinks he's an A. It's because it's conditioning, and it's people are accept where they are, and they know where they are, and they get a little comfortable and lazy. You know, we all do to some extent. Nobody wants to work 24/7, but that's part of it too. And so when you're saying, how do you do that? It's breaking down the barriers department by department.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like what you said. That was one of the superpowers with Goldman Sachs, is their communication was
Oh,
top
yeah.
tier.
Everything there is unlimited. A trillion-dollar IPO, no one will say impossible. You go to Barclays, they'll say that's impossible. You go to Goldman, they're like, yeah, we're probably going to be the one who does that with SpaceX. We're going to have a trillion-dollar, yeah, because they think that way, you know?
That is so fascinating to me. That's funny too, that the B players never self-select as A players.
Right. Never, never once.
Yeah, that's I don't know why that's just very amusing to me. It sort of reminds me of the story I saw, I don't know, a while back, but with the founder of DoorDash, how it made the news because he came in and something was going on and they had really a lot of complaints about the software, and so he started forcing all of the engineers to do an 8-hour customer service shift every month. And it made the news because like 30% of the engineers quit. They're like, I'm not a customer service person. I'm not going to do it. But then the engineers were answering
Yeah.
the support tickets, being like, well, what do you mean the person doesn't understand that thing? It's so obvious. And then they were
Yeah.
like, oh, wait, people are using our thing and it's not working. Oh, I would have never thought of, to do it that way. So yeah, it's interesting.
And Travis, that's the hardest job in every company, in my opinion, is the customer
Customer
support.
service.
I made an effort when I got there. I was like, I want to be able to do every single person here's job, because it might come to that, because that's how crazy we are. If this whole thing falls apart, I'll be there answering the phones, because I don't give up. Like, and so there were people that sent a message to employees day one. So I worked very closely with the sales team. I would take on new clients. I would field every now and then. I closed four of the largest clients in the company's 20-year history when I had moved to Seattle, because it was, you know, I wanted to show, just not just sit there and talk about numbers, but to just actually do that. And then I would work closely with engineering. I would spend time with the software guys. And I realized every man needs to know his limitations. Software development is a limitation of mine, because I never learned how to code. I probably should have taken that at school. And then customer service, that is an incredible skill set. A customer service for someone at a company like DoorDash, or one of the companies that we bought, which are software companies, incredibly hard. You have to be able to go into user accounts and account management software, and so I have a lot of respect for those
People are
people, and they're
usually
all,
upset when they're contacting you because they're frustrated over
they're not
something.
happy. It's really tough. It is a really tough job, but that's important too, as a piece of advice. Always try to be able, if you're a founder, or try to show your employees that you can do every single one of their job, and make an effort, maybe once a month or something, like go down to the customer support team, take a call, just like just say, hey, you know, the founder's here, he'd like to answer the phone. And just take a call and get live customer feedback. We always were fanatical about that. What are customers saying? Why do they want to leave when they leave? You just disconnect their account and say it's canceled. You don't like make it impossible for them to cancel. Like, so the first thing we did was we had incentives for year-long contracts, and then we addressed wait time. We addressed these little things because we were starting to listen to the customer, and we did this thing of VOC, voice of the customer feedback, and you learn a lot just by talking to clients.
Yeah, wow, that's fascinating. All right, so let's get down into the what I love about our conversations. You know, most of the people that I've had on the show or part of this book are in the founder operator mode, and you're now, and you know, a lot of them are trying to find investment or, you know, grow to exit. You're on the opposite side now. You're looking down, going, is that a good investment? Do we want to acquire them? So can you walk me through a little bit about what do you look for? Because you said you had a superpower to be able to recognize a good investment versus a bad investment. So can you give me a, is there criteria, like a checkbox of like what makes a good investment and the checkboxes for what makes a bad investment?
Absolutely. You know, when we look at an investment, we start with you know, durability before we think about upside. So we want, you know, businesses, assets, or strategies that can survive different market environments and not just perform in one market cycle. So stability at the core always comes first. Second, we look for asymmetry. And what I mean by that means limited downside relative to the potential upside. So if the worst case scenario is too damaging, right, or the upside is too incremental, it's not interesting to us. We want solutions where the risk reward profile goes in our favor like that, right? So that asymmetric upside. And then we focus, say the third thing, you know, out of the five, I'm going to give you five. The third one is leadership, right? And so strong management, aligned incentives, all that matter to us because, you know, we can't have poor execution. So we need a team that's driven and that's working on that, that have achieved big things, because think about it, how is a good company going to come forward with a bad team? And then the fourth, we care about capital discipline. So what's going on with the money, as I say, capital, right? What's the story here? Has it been, you know, what's the return on investment capital? What's their reinvestment strategy? What's their balance sheet growth? And how does management, right, think about this and long-term value? Because when you really think deeply about it, right, if you're such a great company, you don't need outside investors. You think Warren Buffett needs us? Absolutely not. He just took it public and, you know, you people can buy shares, but they could take it private again. No one will ever be able to, you know, have a stake in such a wonderful, you know, world-class investment operating machine. You know, same thing, right? You think, you know, Elon Musk needs us, right? He doesn't, right? So these, you know, the world-class, truly outstanding businesses don't really have a need for outside capital because it's managed so well. So it's got to be some sort of unique opportunity, unique story where they even want to have a discussion with someone about investment. So that's four. And then the fifth is, does it fit in our portfolio design? What I mean by that is, like, every investment has a role. Some are like, you know, is like a compounding engine of growth. Others are, you know, strategic bets. Others are defensive, and others are, you know, just sort of opportunistic. And so if it doesn't strengthen the overall portfolio, even a good investment for someone else could be very, you know, could be bad for us. An example I always bring up is manufacturing is an incredible, if you know what you're doing, but for someone like me, I never had experience in manufacturing. I'm not going to start now. So like when somebody shows me this great, like a banker, like thinks I'm taking stupid pills. Is like, you see the margin? I'm like, yeah, but like, it just doesn't fit with, and it's that fifth category. It's just not with our design. And so everybody's got something different. Other people are, you know, manufacturing people and they won't touch services. They're like, why would you do a software business, a service business, when you can own the operation? And they see it very differently. So I don't even argue with some people because it's just against our portfolio design. It just didn't, we don't have a home for it.
That's so fascinating. That makes absolute sense to me. I'm just thinking of a couple of clients that I have, and one's they're both real estate investors, but one is basically residential and the other guy's only commercial. And it's funny because they will each tell you why the other one's not a good investment. So like the commercial guy's like, this is why I would never invest in residential. And the residential guy's like, this is why I don't do commercial. Even though, you know, both of them got
it. I just agree to disagree with people. When that happens, because I know I'm not going to I'm not convincing. It's the way I see it. And that's cognitive bias. Everyone's got their own cognitive bias, right? Warren Buffett, arguably the greatest dollar for dollar investor in the world, not rate of return, but dollar for dollar. And he missed out on Microsoft, Nvidia, Amazon, Google, Netflix, right? Missed out, just missed it because he's so set in the way he invests and he doesn't like technology that much. Now he's in his retirement, he's recently branched out. They've accumulated a little bit of Google, but they've still missed out a lot on Nvidia. They missed out on some of the biggest winners of the century. And that's because he has his own disciplined view of what he's looking for. And is anyone going to call him dumb or, you know, crazy or, you know, right? So it's just that he has a portfolio design that's different.
Well, you said something to me you said something that's really powerful to me, in that, you know, a good investment for someone else may be a bad investment for us. And I think non-investors, they don't care. They don't think that way, right? They're just like, how do I make the best money, right? And so, like you said, so then you get people that are like a good examples, people who don't understand money are like, everybody's, you got to buy Bitcoin. And, Bitcoin's $70,000. And they're like, oh, I better buy Bitcoin. And you're going, okay, but do you know why? And they're like, no, I don't. Right. So it makes sense for somebody, but for some people, it didn't. So I just think that's really important of knowing like what your strengths and your weaknesses are. So that's super fascinating.
Absolutely.
So I want to respect your time. I want to thank you for being here. So let's say somebody's reading this chapter of the book, or they're listening to the show, and maybe it's a founder, and they're going, man, I think my company might be a really good fit to partner with you. Where do people go to find you or connect with you or your team?
Yeah, sure. So you just go find us at eagleglobalholdings.com. And you know, it says it right there. If you've got an idea, if you're working on something, we'd love to read. We'd love to connect with you. And we're a family office built around one core idea, right? Discipline capital allocation over long-term horizon. So we're there for the long term. We invest across public equities, private equity, venture, select real estate. But everything is driven by growth and management first. And so, it's about what really makes us different is the way we blend our entrepreneurial judgment with institutional discipline. So we're not just passive investors, we're operators, strategists, capital architects. It's really about, being opportunistic. And so if you're looking for somebody to really help you who's been there as an operator, as an investor, across different things, it's important to note that that's what's different about us too. A lot of family offices are just investors by background, and that's what they've done. They've just done deals. I've done deals. I've been an EOI, I say, an entrepreneur, an operator, and an investor all at once. So our team here is very positioned and skilled to work with people anywhere around the globe. EagleGlobalHoldings.com, and you can reach us at info. INFO at eagleglobalholdings.com.
Awesome. Michael, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a fantastic conversation. I appreciate it.